All right, I think it's time for us to begin. This is the time and the place for the session entitled The Ethics and Meaning of Suffering. We'd like to welcome you. We would remind you that admission to the sessions is by name tag or ticket, and registration is available in the lobby. We do appreciate your cooperation with that. I'm pleased to introduce our presenters this afternoon. Our main presenter will have a half an hour, and our respondent will have another 15 minutes, and then we'll try to reserve the remaining time for questions and participation from the audience. Our main presenter on this topic is Professor Courtney Campbell from Oregon State University. He is an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy, and he's also director of the Program for Ethics, Science, and the Environment. He holds a BA from Yale University in Religious Studies and a PhD and an MA from the University of Virginia in Religious Studies. He has a number of publications and is married and has four children. Our respondent is Dr. David Green, who is a pediatrician here in the Salt Lake area. He's an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Utah, a member of the Division of Medical Ethics, and is also the medical director of the Utah State Developmental Center. He holds a BS from BYU and an MD from the University of Utah. Without further ado, then, we will turn the time to Professor Campbell, and then upon completion of his paper, we'll hear from Dr. Green.
Thank you. Two remarks really sort of frame the discussion that I want to provoke amongst you about the concept of suffering and the theology of suffering. The first is a comment my mother made to me following the death of her mother earlier this year from a sudden heart attack, and that was that how grateful she was that her mother didn't suffer. The second comment comes from some of my students who I teach at Oregon State University. I teach a death and dying class there, another kind of very interesting topic. In our introductory session, I asked those students, what is it, or what are you doing when you feel most fully alive or most fully aware of yourself? And if you know, when you ask that kind of question to college students, you're going to get a whole range of answers, some of which are not repeatable in this audience. But I'm often struck by how frequently I will get responses when I feel pain or when I feel suffering. So what I'm the dynamic that I'm trying to work with today is really framed by those two remarks. On the one hand, suffering seems to be something that we want to avoid for people. On the other hand, it does seem for many people to have kind of a central part of their religious and spiritual life, such that it becomes an occasion for fullest self-awareness. And this has been recognized even by the critics of religion, such as Karl Marx. Marx, for example, immediately preceding his very famous maxim that religion is the opium of the people, wrote, "Religious suffering is at the same time an expression of real suffering and a protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the sentiment of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions." I mean, suffering for Marx, suffering on Marx's account was really at the heart of religion. He didn't agree with the conclusion, but he certainly recognized the centrality of it. Well, as I think about what kind of place suffering has in our particular society, in our discourse, it seems to me that there are many kinds of currents within medicine and within medical ideology, within our political culture, and within philosophy in general, that seek to banish suffering or eradicate or deny the objective reality of suffering, the objective reality of suffering that even Marx was willing to admit to. Our cultural ethos is one that's directed towards banishing suffering, I think. Within, for example, when I speak to my colleagues friends in medicine, I'm frequently told that to develop a theology of suffering, such as I'll do today, or a philosophy of suffering, is really pointless, because at some point down the road, medical technology will allow us to relieve suffering completely. And besides, the professional imperative within medicine to relieve the pain and suffering of a patient suggests that medicine looks upon suffering as really an evil, perhaps an unmitigated or unredeemed evil. Its presence in the experience of a patient is really a symbol of human failure, and all we need really is to give a kind of, to apply our technology a little bit further, and we'll be able to conquer suffering as we conquered many diseases and as we try to manage and control pain. Well, part of the reason I think that the caregivers and the professionals, and my respondent today can speak probably to this very directly, I suspect, but part of the reason I attribute this sentiment amongst caregivers about suffering is a kind of immediacy of experience. I mean, they experience suffering amongst their patients in a way that perhaps I don't have access to that kind of experience. It's an example of what I call moral distance. That is, the farther one is away from the kind of experience one has, your perspective changes. And the French existentialist Albert Camus hit on this idea of moral distance and its importance in relation to the idea of suffering, I think, very nicely in his novel The Plague, where he criticizes the ways that traditional religious ideas and attitudes have tried to domesticate suffering. And so he, through the voice of his character, Dr. Ryu, Camus writes in The Plague, the local priest is a man of learning, a scholar. He hasn't come in contact with death. And that's why he can speak with such assurance of the truth, with a capital T. But all who have heard a man gasping for breath on his deathbed think as I do. He tried to relieve human suffering before trying to point out its excellence. I think religious traditions often, and including the LDS tradition, sometimes have tried to praise suffering rather than trying to relieve it, to see suffering as an intrinsic good. And that's a mistake that we need to avoid. On the other hand, I do want to suggest that there are these very strong currents that I want to discuss in a minute within medicine, within our liberal political culture, and within philosophy that would deny that suffering has any significance at all, and I think that is equally mistaken. So basically what I would like to do is work through four major themes. The first is to look at these medical, political, and philosophical ideologies that tend to diminish the significance of suffering as an experience for individuals and render it morally and religiously meaningless. Secondly, I want to say, look, people do suffer, they claim that they suffer. Why is this? And for that, we need some kind of understanding of who we are as human beings. That is, I want to look at the nature of the self. And the relationship between suffering and the nature of the self. And then I want to look at what I call the ordeal of suffering, that is, the passages or the marks of suffering. What is it to experience suffering? And then lastly, I want to take up the question about what kind of quest we're engaged on when we think we can gain purpose, meaning, and significance through this experience of suffering, such that, again, to refer to my students, the highest state of self-awareness for some of them occurs when they're in pain and suffering. So that's where I'm going to go. Let me look first then at these ideologies which I think try to banish and are seeking to, in various kinds of ways, banish suffering from our discourse culturally. Within medicine, I see what I call a pronounced tendency towards the medicalization of suffering. That is, suffering is often coupled with pain. So we talk about the professional's imperative relief, not simply pain, but also suffering. And suffering is seen as kind of on a continuum with pain. such that if we can control pain through various kinds of technologies, it's just going to be a little while down the road before we're able to also conquer or alleviate suffering as well. What is going on in the medicalization of suffering is we're trying to seek a technical solution to what, on my account, is a very deep metaphysical problem. And we ought to know very well that this coupling of pain and suffering is in itself problematic, because one can experience pain without suffering, such as the death of my grandmother, and one can also suffer without experiencing pain, such as the response of my mother to that experience. Or if we often talk about, say, long-suffering Red Sox or Cubs fans or something like that, who aren't really experiencing pain, but we use the language of suffering to describe their experience, and I'll try and explain why that is a little bit later. If this kind of coupling or this medicalization of suffering doesn't really work, another strategy or another approach is to deny the objective reality of suffering. Suffering is, I think, very much a subjective, individualized phenomenon, and thus it's many times very hard to share with another person the kind of experience that one has. But this very subjectivity of suffering makes it very problematic when one tries to place it within the context of contemporary medicine, with some of its basic presuppositions about objectivity of knowledge, about quantification of results, and about an understanding of the person as essentially a kind of organic machine. I'd like to, a person that is very concerned about this, a very articulate physician, Eric Cassell, has written the following, which I think speaks volumes about this particular point. Cassell has written that the central assumptions on which 20th century medicine is founded provide no basis for an understanding of suffering. The dominance and success of science in our time has led to the widely held and crippling prejudice that no knowledge is real unless it is scientific, that is, objective and measurable. From this perspective, suffering and its dominion in the sick person are themselves unreal. Well, if that's true, then suffering has a really medicine has a really serious problem on its hands, I think, when it cannot comprehend or understand the very experience that it's committed to relieve by its professional imperatives to relieve pain and suffering. At some points, the difficulty that suffering poses for our contemporary medical culture, I think, spills over into our contemporary liberal political culture. And just by way of example or illustration, within the last 4 years, several initiatives on physician-assisted suicide have been proposed in the Pacific Northwest states. One will be voted on this year in my... I guess it's my home state of Oregon. I'm not sure where my home state is anymore. And in each of these initiatives for physician-assisted suicide, the aspiration is to ensure, a terminally ill patient, in each case, a death with dignity. And the major concern, or a dignified death, is the provision of certain kind of medication, say Seconal or some other drug to a terminally ill patient. And it's clearly provided at providing what one author refers to as self-deliverance from the suffering that a terminally ill patient might normally undergo if they were to follow the natural course of their disease prior to the end of their life. This approach provides, at least for medical culture, something that the other approaches can't do. That is, it helps medical caregivers solve the problem of suffering. They do that by taking the life of the suffering person. So we might be able to defeat suffering, but we do so only at the cost of making some persons victims of a morality that's intolerant to suffering. A second concern that I have with this particular with the status or the significance of suffering within a liberal political culture is that, as reflected in these initiatives, is there's no sort of conception of dignified suffering or purposeful or meaningful suffering. I mean, it just doesn't fit with the conception of human dignity. What constitutes human dignity within the context of these various political initiatives is that a terminally ill patient has control and choice, the right of self-determination. And there's a clear severance or a clear distinction between a person's dignity and their ability to choose or their inability to choose. So one wants to ask of this political ideology in our liberal culture, what place does it give to suffering? I think the answer to that is very little, if any. I might say very briefly that although this kind of issue, I think, raises some important questions for the LDS Church. I mean, because physician-assisted suicide or physician aid in dying doesn't really fall into the kinds of categories that current ecclesiastical teaching has addressed. Current ecclesiastical teaching has developed some positions on refusing medical treatment and on euthanasia in the sense of killing a terminally ill patient, but that's not exactly what's going on with physician-assisted suicide. An LDS teaching on suicide in general has tended to, at least within the last 10 or so years, evolve to the point of condemning the act but holding blameless or at least reserving final judgment of the actor or the agent to divine judgment. Within these physician-assisted suicide initiatives, however, the presumption is, and not the presumption, I mean the mandate is, that the person has to be making a rational choice. So that doesn't square at all with any kind of ecclesiastical teaching on this. So it's unclear to me, it is fairly clear to me what the LDS position ought to be if there was one that was articulated. It's unclear to me why there hasn't been one that's been formally articulated. I might contrast this kind of position with the position that's articulated with the Roman Catholic tradition, where there's a very clear prohibition of both euthanasia and assisted suicide. But the reason is not because of, say, some statement that it violates principles about suicide or thou shalt not kill. Rather, in Roman Catholic teaching, the affirmation is that suffering, especially suffering during the last moments of life, has a special place in God's saving plan. It is, in fact, a sharing in Christ's passion. That is, there's a real sense of trying to make suffering purposeful within the latter stage of one's life. I think philosophical ethics, philosophical traditions, really do not do any better in trying to make sense of suffering than either the medical ideologies I referred to or the political ideologies I've referred to. And I want to just, by illustration, just talk about one, which is the stance of utilitarianism. Utilitarianism is a moral theory that says we ought to do the greatest good for the greatest number of people, basically. And it was the founder of utilitarianism in the 18th century, Jeremy Bentham, said that what gives any entity sort of status within the moral community, moral standing, is what he called the capacity for suffering or sentience. Okay, and that didn't necessarily limit it to human beings. In fact, he was very critical of what he called anthropomorphism, that is to say that only human beings have moral standing or moral status. So Bentham said, no, it's not our capacity for language or a capacity for reason that gives us moral standing, it's this capacity to suffer. And he and his follower, John Stuart Mill, very influential in terms of the Anglo-American legal tradition, said that this criterion of sentience applied not only to human beings, but to all of sentient creation. That is, they would apply it to animals as well. At the same time, utilitarianism joins the liberal and the medical perspectives in seeking to eradicate suffering from human existence. Mill wanted to emphasize that science and public health programs provided powerful resources for us to minimize and eventually conquer suffering. To quote from his classic essay, Utilitarianism, all the grand sources of human suffering are in a great degree, many of them almost entirely, conquerable by human care and effort. Now, it seems to me that utilitarianism in dealing with suffering faces the same kind of paradox that medicine does. Medicine is committed to relieving suffering, a phenomenon which, at least on Cassell's account, it doesn't fully understand. Utilitarianism is committed to eradicating from human existence a phenomenon, suffering, which provides the basis for moral standing or moral rights or moral obligations or moral responsibilities in the first place. So if Mill's vision were to be borne out that we actually did, in fact, conquer suffering, then say something seriously damaging about that whole train of moral philosophy. And one could look at other traditions. I don't have the time nor, in some sense, the expertise to go through a laundry list of various moral traditions on this. Well, what I want to say then in conclusion is, not conclusion to the whole thing, we're not done yet, conclusion to this section is, it's just simply that there are some very strong traditions within our culture that would make of suffering just, that we either seek to deny suffering or make of it a meaningless experience, and thus we ought to try with all the best either discursive or technological tools at our disposal eradicate it from our existence. I think the problem that runs into is the fact that these traditions don't deal adequately with the reality that human beings do seem to suffer. And if you sort of try and banish this experience or deny people a voice to express their experience of suffering, you're going to have some real problems. And so what I want to do very briefly is just suggest that where some of these traditions have gone wrong is in understanding who we are as selves, who we are as human beings. So I want to talk for a little bit about what I call the suffering self. So far, you might have noticed I've just complained about people who were arguing about suffering. I haven't defined suffering. And suffering, on my interpretation, is an actual or perceived threat of dissolution to the integrity and the identity of oneself. Suffering calls into question the continuity of the I to which I refer to myself. And it's a very personalized and particularized kind of threat. It's my loyalties, it's my interests, it's myself that are challenged by suffering, not yours. I'll frequently express that in a sense of a loss of control over life choices, over bodily functions and so forth, or a feeling of powerlessness. That to me is sort of the fundamental core of a kind of a definition of suffering. And the occasion for suffering may well be certainly life's traumas, death, divorce, other kinds of experiences that we go through in which ourselves are diminished. It can be, again, losing the seventh game of the World Series. I mean, if you're a Boston Red Sox fan and you saw Bill Buckner miss that ball in the sixth game of the World Series in 1986, I mean, you were suffering. Since I lived up in that area at that time, I know very much what that suffering was about. Why is that? Well, because one's identity as a person is so bound up with one's team. I suspect when the Utah Jazz lose in the playoffs, you go through kind of a mourning period like people do in Portland when the Trailblazers get kicked out of the playoffs, because again, one's self-identity is bound up with this particular team. So again, suffering is a threat to one's identity and integrity as a self, the threat of dissolution, and it, obviously in certain circumstances that self is really at stake. It's possibility of continuation, particularly through the experiences of disease and illness and death. Given that, I want to say that suffering isn't so much a problem that we ought to try and solve as I think the medical, the philosophical, and the political ideologies understand suffering, that is, as a problem to solve, but rather it's a condition that we experience as part of who we are as human beings. To rephrase René Descartes, I suffer, therefore I am. And to seek to engage in eradicating suffering from the human experience is itself, I would argue, a form of dehumanization. Now, the problem that I think the various traditions get into is that they have a very truncated, limited view of the self. The view of the self that's very popular in liberal Western culture, and that view of the self is simply that what's important about the self is the self has the capacity to choose. Doesn't matter what the self chooses, just so long as it has the capacity to choose. Okay, choices and decision-making are all important. In medicine, we refer to this as sort of the principle of autonomy or the principle of self-determination. There's no content given to the choice itself, whether it's right or wrong. It's just the affirmation of the right to choose that's very important. And that's basically all that liberal culture has to say about the notion of the self. So long as you can make a choice, you have an authentic self. So long as you can make a decision for yourself, you have an autonomous self. That kind of account of the self, I do not think, can give any place to the experience of suffering, because suffering presupposes, as I've tried to suggest, not enhanced self-determination, enhanced control of choices. It proposes precisely the opposite, which is the prospect of self-dissolution. And in some sense, liberal culture has already dissolved the moral self. So it's no wonder that it can't give any place to an ideal of suffering, or an idea of suffering in its discourse. So I think what we need to do is to articulate a fuller account of the self that will give at least some significance to suffering, or some place or some status for it, to make sense of the reality of suffering that people in fact do experience. And very, very briefly, just let me articulate what I think those features of the self have to include. And these are based in, or grounded for me, in some theological convictions based in the fact that human beings, I understand human beings to be created in the image of God, the Imago Dei, and we are called to the imitation of God, or the imitatio Dei, we're called to the imitation of the divine presence in the world. Given that, the self has the following kinds of characteristics, and because of time, I won't try to defend these. I guess I'll just have to whip through these pretty quickly. The self is a self that's constituted by relationships and sociality, in contrast to the independent self that makes independent choices of liberal political culture. It's a self that's shaped by history. It's a self that's rooted in particular identity, an identity of past, present, and the prospect of future, rather than, again, the self of liberal culture, which tends to see things sort of in the moment, in the here and now, and I'll make my choice in the here and now. For suffering to be perceived as a threat at all, you've got to have a stable sense of self over a period of time that includes past, present, and future. It's a self that is embedded in characteristics of creativity and communication. In constructing our own kinds of understandings of the world, but in engaging that construction, we have to understand that we're also accountable for that kind of creativity and the kind of communication that we engage in. This ought to give to us a disposition, I think, of humility rather than the hubris and the pride that I think so characterizes the self of liberal culture. Because, after all, humility, at least I want to say that this disposition of humility is so important because I think it's the meek that are those that inherit the earth, probably because they're the only ones that recognize that they are of the earth. Because if one looks at the root etymologies of our terms for human being, earth, and of humility, they all come from the same word, humus. So the meek inherit the earth because they recognize that they are of the earth, rather than, again, some kind of independent independent entity with no sense of ties to others. Finally, I want to say that this image of the self is also an embodied self. We're not just minds or legislative wills, as some of the philosophical traditions would hold it. The body is very significant in how we experience life and certainly how we experience suffering as well. Okay, that was quick, but that was all the time I have for that. Given that, what then happens in suffering? If that's some characterization of the notion of the self, that at least is minimally required for suffering to even be an intelligible concept, let alone, you know, trying to make it a meaningful concept, just to give it some intelligibility. What does the sufferer experience? What I want to suggest is basically what I call four passages or four marks of suffering. And again, for purposes of time, I'll go through these very quickly, and then if you want me to expand on them later in questions, I'll be happy to do so. First, I want to say that the person that suffers experiences what I refer to as, by the metaphor of magnification. That is, faced with the potential multitude of losses that the sufferer is confronted with, the claims of the self and the interests of the self just become all-consuming and over-consuming, and it's a preoccupation with the self. That's what I mean by the concept of magnification. the notion of our self-interest becomes much more present and important to our consciousness. Secondly, the mismagnification of self is accompanied by what I would call an experience of alienation or fragmentation of the self. The self kind of splits. The self might split from its body. The body becomes a hostile other that frustrates our life plans, particularly in disease and chronic disease and terminal disease. The self might split over its sense of values, its sense of identity. It loses a kind of wholeness and harmony. Or the suffering self might become alienated or estranged from other persons who see in the sufferer not a source of compassion for community, but really a source of revulsion and a reason for turning away from rather than turning towards. If part of what the self is constituted by, in my account, is our capacities for creativity and communication, what goes on in the experience of suffering to counter that is, I think, as a third feature, is a diminishment of the experience of being able to use one's voice, or what Elaine Scarry, a philosopher, has referred to as the shattering of language. One isn't able to speak of one's experience in any way that sort of makes sense to other people. In fact, one may not be able to speak at all if one is suffering. Again, the Red Sox fan was likely, when they saw Bill Buckner miss that ball, was either their jaw dropped and they are speechless, or they probably were throwing their TV through the window of their house, but they weren't speaking. They weren't saying, "Oh, let these things happen every day in life." I can guarantee you that. One person who I think has really touched on this point very nicely is a person by the name of Warren Reich. Reich says that the experience of suffering is in part constituted by this attempt, this journey to discover a voice in which one can communicate one's suffering to others. And the first phase of this journey, on his account, is what he calls mute suffering. That is, the sufferer is struck dumb. They're not able to express, at least in conventional patterns of communication, what it is that they're going through. It's not that they may be silent, they may be screaming, they may be moaning, and so forth, but the point is that you're initially unable to communicate your own experience. And that has a couple of important consequences when you think about it from the standpoint of a caregiver. If you're not able to understand what the patient that you're treating is experiencing, you're likely not to be responsive to that. Patients complain all the time about sort of insensitive caregivers. Well, part of that is because they're unable to communicate their own experience to the caregiver. A second kind of consequence is that, lacking these sort of conventional patterns of communication, these patterns in which we do become social beings, the sufferer may well experience a social death long before they experience a biological death. The fourth point I want to make about the experience of suffering is that it encompasses a phenomenon of what I call contraction. And here I'm really drawing on Leo Tolstoy's novel, The Death of Ivan Illich. Contraction in a couple of different kinds of senses. It's pretty nice. I didn't know they listened to what I was saying. Contraction, there's a physical contraction that occurs for the sufferer. One's experience of moves, or one's sort of world, if you will, contracts inward from a natural world in which you're an active participant in the natural environment to a social world, perhaps in an institutionalized setting or perhaps in one's home. Then you become homebound, and then a shut-in, and then bedbound, and so forth. That is, one's, again, mobility contracts. There's also a contraction of the self, in the sense that the self, we turn on ourselves and start asking ourselves, what in the world is going on? Why am I experiencing this? Why is this happening to me? It's that kind of existential contraction. And on Tolstoy's account, in his novel, the answer to those questions, what is the point of this experience, is for no reason. They just are. I mean, that's part of the experience of human beings. Well, these accounts lead me to this experience, this kind of these marks and passages of suffering lead me to concur with Camus that it is important to relieve suffering rather than singing its spiritual praises. And to the extent that we opt for the second approach, we've made some important mistakes. What I want to do very briefly in conclusion, because I know I've exhausted my time, is just suggest a couple of ways in which I think that those mistakes can be avoided. I think that there is an important lesson to be learned from the narrative paradigm of Job, not so much from the discourse that goes on or the story of Job per se, but an important lesson about the response of his friends initially. Not their mistaken comments later and their judgmental comments later, but initially, according to the narrative, this is what happened. When Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they each came from his own place, and they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. I think that's enormously insightful. So often we run around and think to the sufferer, you know, what can I do to help? I need to do something to help that person, when what is really needed is just some compassionate human presence, just being there. In the way that Job's friends were in that initial part of the narrative. The author of that narrative recognized, I think insightfully, that to say, "I know how you feel," to the sufferer is isolating language. The person that is suffering is going to feel skeptical, if not cynical, about how you could know what's very private and intimate knowledge and experience. Moreover, the "I know," that is, "I know how you feel," the "I know" in that statement again deprives the sufferer of giving his or her voice to his or her own experience. You take that away from them. So what I want to say is that in the presence of suffering, we shouldn't be praising its excellence. We may, with Job's friends, be present but silent and let the sufferer find his or her voice. I think we can say with truthfulness, not "I know how you feel," but "I don't know how you feel, but I'm here with you and here for you so that you may tell me of your suffering." The way of what I call compassion, the compassionate response to suffering, is an invitation to the sufferer to find his or her own voice, to express his or her experience. This language of expressive suffering may be lamentation. It may be used in narratives, Job, Jesus, Joseph Smith in Liberty Jail, and so forth. Or metaphor, but those narratives or that voice gives the sufferer some sense of control and power in the face of their threatened disillusion. The story, the narratives of suffering, doesn't itself provide meaning, but provides a context for meaning to be constructed and shared by those that are attending and giving care to the sufferer. So I want to say that a narrative in which there is kind of shared concern and compassion is a profound act of religious community and provides a context for meaning through a shared story rather than imposing a meaning from an alien story. Finally, I want to say, and I've sort of obliquely alluded to this by using the metaphor of contraction to say that's one of the formative experiences of suffering. Contraction is the name that we give to the biological ordeal of labor by which newness comes into the world. New life, new innocence, new potentiality, by which the world finds a means of sustenance, healing, and regeneration. By analogy, I want to say that the existential kind of contraction that transpires in our ordeals of suffering can be a prelude to the recovery of the self, that self whose wholeness and integrity is not so much maintained or preserved intact as it is reconstituted and enlarged. It's my anticipation that there will be a time of healing when, according to the book of Revelations, God will wipe every tear from their eyes, death shall be no more, neither shall there be mourning or crying nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. But in the order of this world, the fact of the human condition is we suffer, and it behooves us, and I think my critique of some of the currents in medical ideology, philosophical ideology, and political ideology is that they seek to solve a problem which is fundamentally a metaphysical problem by technical means. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank Courtney for his presentation. I thought it was clear, and I appreciated it a great deal, and I also admire him. I can't imagine a topic in philosophy that's been addressed less than suffering. And it doesn't seem to be a particularly popular topic in religion either. And I think it takes a lot of courage to sit down and put some words to it and bring it up as an item for discussion. Proposals to explain to make suffering meaningful tend to be put together by people who aren't suffering and tend to be accepted by those who are, and when presented to those who are, tend to be rather quickly rejected up front, probably the reason why there's so little written about it. I'd just like to make a couple of comments about the structure of the paper, and then there is an area here where I think we disagree, and perhaps we can use that as a focus for some discussion. Courtney starts by presenting to you a paradox, and the paradox is that suffering is to be avoided, and the other arm of the paradox is that suffering has inherent value. And my guess is that that won't get a great deal of argument in this audience. And then he mentions, as a framework for some of this discussion, the issue of physician-assisted suicide, which is by no means the core of his paper, but is, I think, key to a lot of what he's talking about, particularly when he talks about medicalization of suffering. When I thought about finding meaning for suffering, was pretty discouraged through the first 12 pages, because he focuses on the arm of the paradox, which is suffering is to be avoided, and succeeds in pointing out quite aptly how badly we've done at that. I imagine that won't get much resistance in this audience either. Just a couple of comments about that, however. One, his assertion that suffering is irreducibly subjective. The problem with this assertion, although I suspect it's true, is that it makes suffering inaccessible to rational ethical analysis. Doesn't mean suffering isn't important, just means we don't have the tools to work with it very well, and it probably explains why philosophy has done such a poor job of trying to make suffering meaningful. I was thinking about his comments about medicine always trying to objectify everyone. I was in the hospital a couple weeks ago, and nurses would come in 4 or 5 times a day and say, "Well, on a scale of 1 to 10, how's your pain today?" Maybe you've had this experience, and, you know, you kind of sat there, well, what's going to happen because of this, you know? And, well, it's a 6. Oh, well, that's good, because it says here yesterday it was a 7. And when it got to 5, they threatened to take away my PCA, and then I was really worried. Another comment is suffering is universal. Autonomy is the most valued principle in our culture, and I really think Courtney's right about that. So suffering is viewed as diminishing autonomy, and that probably explains to a great degree why we don't want to deal with it. It also creates some problems for I think, the definition. Let me get to where I think we might disagree so we can have a minute for some comments. In the last 5 pages of the paper, Courtney tries to get at the issue of the other arm of the paradox, which is suffering has meaning, and I suspect that's the reason everyone came to hear his presentation. And he quickly addresses 3 commonly made arguments suffering has meaning either because it's divine punishment, because it has value in a redemptive sense, or that it is educational in nature. I'd like to suggest to you that most people that are suffering reject all 3 of these up front, and he does also. So I think that enables us to get on to a more meaningful part of the discussion. I then think he makes the argument that an attempt to give meaning to suffering can come through acts of compassion. Now, I don't want you to construe from what I'm going to say next that I'm against compassion. Not at all. I think he's absolutely right about the fact that, and I don't actually know whether you make this argument or not, Courtney, but you can correct me if you don't. I think he's making an argument that we have, and this is an ethical argument, that we have an obligation to be compassionate to those in our community who are suffering. All right? And I don't want to suggest by what I'm going to say next that I disagree with that. I just think that that doesn't, it isn't a particularly useful argument when used in the context of the current controversy over physician-assisted suicide. Okay? If the argument being made here is that compassion is a razor-sharp argument that can be used to solve the conflict over physician-assisted suicide, I'm going to make a brief argument that it will not do that. Not that compassion is not useful with people who are suffering. Okay? I think that if we had more time, that Courtney would argue that compassion would solve the problems associated with suffering that bring us to the considering the issue of physician-assisted suicide. Once again, I may be putting words in his mouth. We can hear about that in a minute. The reason I don't think that it will do that is because I think it's entirely possible to have a loving relationship with an individual who's suffering and to show characteristics of compassion that would be recognized as such by those around you, and to have the individual say, love you, please give me the pills. Now, I hate to put it that way, but that's actually the way that a lot of the discussion has arisen in our country over the last year. I don't want to talk about Dr. Kevorkian. Many of you may be familiar with a famous story told by Dr. Timothy Quill in the New England Journal of Medicine almost 3 years ago now about a patient of his named Diane. And the story is wonderful, and I would hope you'd all get a chance to read it. I don't think it'll convince you of anything one way or another, but I think it does give a great deal of insight into what can happen in patient-physician relationships. But this is briefly the story of a young woman with cancer, clearly a unique person, who chooses to forego treatment for her cancer because she does not want to. She thinks the odds are bad, and she does not want to undergo the suffering associated with it. The relationships she has with both her own family and the physician could be characterized as long, enduring discussion. Now, we don't have access to those conversations. We don't know what they're really like, but that certainly is the way they're described, and they're described at length by Dr. Quill. And at the end, the reluctant physician, Dr. Quill, is drugged to the decision that she is asking him to give her a prescription for pills to end her life, and he's reluctant to do that, but finds himself compelled by his compassion for her to write the prescription. And he describes this in elaborate detail. So I think that if compassion is used here as an attempt to solve this controversy or conflict, it won't do that. Compassion will be used by those people on both sides of the argument, both by people who support some form of physician-assisted suicide or those who reject it. Thank you.
Thank you to both of our presenters, and we do have some time for some commentary. Let's start back here in this corner. And I'll try to repeat the question quickly for the benefit of the tape. Well, we need to get it on the tape, too.
Actually, this is not a question. But, Courtney, if you have not done so already, I'm going to make a suggestion that you further your studies into the practical world. Now, I realize I'm not objecting that what you presented is not part of the practical world. As a war historian, I have talked to veterans from World War II who were captured by the Japanese and tortured for 4 years. four of whom returned, one of whom is your Utah on LDS, Korean veterans who were captured by the Chinese and the North Koreans, who met up with a new kind of torture, physical as well as mental. Our Vietnamese veterans, some of whom were tortured for 5 to 7 years, and then in more recent years are hostages in Lebanon. The question is raised, why did some survive that suffering, the worst kind of suffering, unlike anything you have ever seen in a hospital room? Think about that.
Okay, we need to hurry because there's several other people who have questions.
This perhaps is the most important. Spencer W. Kimball gave a talk at a general conference in the 1970s. I can't cite the year. But it was on the subject of wisdom. The significant point that he made was that after suffering comes the wisdom.
Okay, our question just briefly refers to the real experience of people who have endured suffering through wartime experiences, and the point from President Kimball that suffering precedes wisdom. Dr. Campbell, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I guess I don't need to be lectured by anyone about what the nature of suffering is. I mean, I think I know personally well enough what I'm talking about here. I think I know personally what the experience of suffering is, and so insofar as I may be distanced from the experience of war veterans, I'm quite willing to concede that point. But I don't think this is completely ivory tower academies that I've offered to you today. I'd recommend to you that you go and read Elaine Scarry's book, where she talks about the experience of war veterans and the experience of suffering and torture, because she has about 200 pages devoted to that and their experience. And I've drawn very heavily on that experience, which in her book, The Body in Pain, and she talks about torture as the making and unmaking of one's world. And again, it's drawn centrally from both war veterans, but also hostages and their experiences. I don't know that what I've argued is at least incompatible with what she's argued in that particular book. Nor for that matter, I'm not sure exactly what your point of criticism is, other than to say broaden my scope of research, which I'm quite willing to do. That point I'll certainly accept, but I don't know that the theory of suffering that I've tried to offer is incompatible with that. As far as the point of whether suffering is the prelude to wisdom, I'm not denying that. I did, fortunately my respondent was able to pick out a couple of points that I didn't get to in my paper, but I do dismiss in the paper that suffering is necessarily an educational process, that all things will be for your experience and for your good, to quote a famous passage from the Doctrine and Covenants. But if you recall, I do argue at the end, and I did state this at the end, that I do think that suffering provides a context that people will tell their stories, their lamentations, their narratives, their experience, provides a context for shared meaning. So I would argue that the wisdom is not wisdom that comes to a person individually, but it's a wisdom that's shared collectively. So in that sense, I would, I don't have any fundamental disagreement with what you say.
Dave, anything? Just one quick comment. You raised an interesting question about individual response to suffering, which I can't really shed any light on, except to say that that it's clear that suffering is experienced dramatically differently by individuals. And since it's subjective, it's not very accessible to study, and we don't know really very much about it. In pediatrics, which is my area of training, we're very interested in why two children grow up in the same terrible environment, and one of them has a lot of trouble and the other one doesn't. And, we haven't been able to shed much light on that, unfortunately, but it's a key issue.
Right here in the green dress.
Could you talk a little bit about the difference between suffering and self-pity? I think sometimes that we talk about suffering as being a very personal and a
question regards the distinction between suffering and self-pity. Either one of you care to respond on that? And do it here for the tape.
Well, I think the person that is engaged in sort of pitying of self has sort of worked through has experienced those kinds of passages of suffering. That is, they've experienced, you know, a magnification. They've experienced alienation or fragmentation. They've experienced the contraction, and the contraction is so significant that they turn completely inward, and all their world, in a sense, becomes oneself, and they aren't able to even allow a kind of openness to others so that you can have the possibility for some compassionate caregiving. I think that what we need to recognize, and again, here's part of my critique against sort of the liberal culture in which we live, which prides itself so much on individualism, on independence, and freedom. What we need to be more cognizant of is our fundamental vulnerability to each other and our fundamental dependency and interdependency upon each other to make it through life, let alone to make choices. And basically, I would say that the person that is sort of caught up in self-pity has closed the doors down to that dependency or that willingness to be vulnerable to the other person so that that person can then invite them to share their kind of story. So that's how I would distinguish those two. But you raise a good point. I mean, there's a whole host of cluster of issues surrounding suffering, anxiety, distress, you know, pity and so forth that come up, and how pity might be related to compassion.
Dave? We've only got another couple of minutes. I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair and pose something that I hope will embody some things that a few of the rest of you have been thinking about. As I listened to this, I heard a couple of things tracked a couple of things. It occurred to me that in our culture, sometimes we feel more discomfort about others' suffering than our own. Sometimes we endure with dignity what's happening to ourselves, but we're not comfortable with we don't tolerate vicarious suffering very well. And sometimes we seek to deny either the reality or the effect of others' suffering. And then our response sometimes is to try to put the victim either out of sight or out of his misery. Do we need to examine our own motives when we seek to spare others from the reality of suffering? And then it occurred to me that there's a distinction between the kinds of suffering that have some kind of a palliative response that's possible, something that you can really do something about. If somebody's hungry, you can give them food. There's other kinds of suffering that don't lend themselves to some physical response or emotional response. They just have to be endured. And I thought the quote from Job and the story of his friends who spent 7 days and seven nights, you know, sometimes I think in our culture, we wouldn't be willing to spend 7 days and seven nights. We'd certainly bring food in if we could, or we'd certainly bring pain pills if we could. But would we spend 7 days and seven nights? I really don't know. I'd like to hear any comments on those distinctions and the story of Job in particular. We're so pragmatic in our culture. Can we really deal with the unresolvable suffering?
I don't want to monopolize this in your time. I guess, and I had made a point of this in my paper, but I think in terms of response to suffering, much of what we do is easier done than it's said, which is kind of different than our normal way of constructing things. And what's done, I think, is the kinds of things that you mentioned. But I also think that's, in some sense, insufficient, that we really need to invite the sufferer to give voice somehow, to find a voice to express his or her suffering and what it means to them personally. And I mean, just to take exception to a couple of the uses of language here, I'm not convinced that we ought to be, I've tried to make this clear, solving the problem of suffering, whether it's in the context of physician-assisted suicide or in general. I don't think it's a problem that can be solved. I think it's a condition that we experience, and it provides an occasion for community and bonding between persons, but I don't think it's a problem that we can solve. Similarly, with respect to vicarious suffering and sparing the suffering of others, ought we to be about sparing people from suffering? In those cases in which we can relieve suffering, I'd say certainly yes. But in many cases, I mean, the etymological root of compassion is that you suffer with another person. It's a collective sharing of the suffering rather than trying to spare the person from their suffering. You assume their burden and take it upon your shoulders. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, I will give you rest, for my yoke is easy, my burden is light. That, I think, is sort of what the kind of Christian response here needs to be.
And I think that's what Job's friends did. They didn't bring truth. They came for 7 days and seven nights.
Our time for the session is up. We'd like to thank you for attending. I'm sure both presenters would be available for a few additional questions afterward. Some of you may be aware, Peggy Fletcher had an article in last Saturday's Tribune about the a physician-assisted suicide kind of initiative in Oregon, and Professor Campbell is quoted in that article in the Tribune about the issues as they're the political issues as they're currently going on in Oregon. I have a few copies of that article if anybody is interested. It gives you a little further insight into Dr. Campbell's views. So thank you for attending, and we'll be adjourned.